biting through the shifting power leans to you, and the cord is on a wheel.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Brunson, your host for Wednesday morning call and talk radio here on Kibu Community Radio, where the time is 26 minutes before 8 o'clock, and the number to call to join in the conversation this morning is 503-231-8187. Well, this is another in a series of special programming we've been doing called the Whole Communities Radio Project, and this morning we're going to be talking about the new burgeoning city of Damascus on the southeast flanks of Portland. And I have with me in the studio Stephen Metzler, who is an urban architect and planner who's been involved with some of the design concepts, particularly around preserving natural resources in what is a naturally resource-laden area. Diana Lobo, who is a three-term member of the Committee for the Future of Damascus and was one of those people that got the ball rolling to get Damascus incorporated as a city so they could actually be doing what they're doing now, as opposed to, well, we'll be discussing what the option would have been. And Nina Postle, who was on the show back in July when we had our part one, the Damascus Concept Plan. So this is actually the Damascus Concept Plan 2 program today. And Dean is also an urban planner and Damascus resident, lives on a small organic farm, and has been a loud voice in hoping that things go in particular ways, in particularly preserving natural resources in the Damascus area. So we're going to be talking for the next hour and a half about what's happening in Damascus, why Damascus is getting urbanized, and what direction that can take. But before we do that, we're going to listen to a short feature produced by one of the interns in the Whole Communities Radio Project, which, besides having these special panels, we've been running a series of training workshops for Kibu volunteers where they are honing their radio skills and producing very fine features like the one we're about to hear by Becca Bartleson.
In late 2002, Metro, the Portland, Oregon regional government, expanded the urban growth boundary to include the city of Damascus. Damascus, a rural farming community, is slated to grow into an urban area in a relatively short period of time. Can Damascus continue to be a livable community and retain its rural character in the face of such enormous changes? To address this challenge, a group of Damascus residents, with help from the Coalition for a Livable Future and local government officials, have put together the Damascus Concept Plan.
My name is Diana Lobo, and I'm a resident of Damascus, have been for about 13 years. When the UGB expansion was proposed in 2002, there were a number of us who heard about this, and there were very few people, if any, who were thrilled about the idea. And some of us saw an opportunity to protect this beautiful place and to create a new place to live that would be unique.
We're going to take a community that's currently 10,000 people to about 60,000 people.
John Hartsock is the mayor pro tem for the city of Damascus.
So that's a dramatic increase, and it's going to look different than it does today. But can we cluster that development? Can we keep that development so that there is some green space between it, that there is a feel of a little bit more of a rural community? It's not going to look like it does today. It can't, and accommodate that many people.
I am standing with Dean Apostle, a Damascus resident and landscape architect who was involved in the planning process. We are at the proposed site for the new downtown Damascus, just off of Highway 212. Farm and small residential dwellings stretch out behind the dilapidated barn before us.
The current edge of the urban center is going to be at the highway here, where we see Highway 212. So the highway is going to be the what we're calling the Champs Damascus, which would be a tree-lined boulevard, east-west, 4 miles, that links the town center where we're standing with the old town center of Damascus, where the Safeway and the Bi-Mart are.
This is going to be a transitional area for a long time.
Damascus resident Diana Lobo.
And that's not a bad thing. We just need to go at it one step at a time, and having the transitional agricultural areas will give us an option to do that in a really constructive way. And I would love to see that kind of thing be a permanent fixture where the produce continues to be locally grown, continues to be readily available, and then we've got a healthier community.
If Damascus is to become an urban center, this loosely populated semi-rural area will experience a dramatic increase in density, which is hard for many current residents to accept. Again, Dean Apostle.
The planning is supposed to take it in the direction of a more pedestrian-friendly place, but it requires a lot of things that we don't know if we can have yet. One is enough density to make it work. There's a lot of resistance against density in the community for very good reasons. If we go too low density, you don't get stores close enough to where people live, and you don't get enough transit.
On the other hand, the Damascus concept plan will also encourage preservation of green spaces both inside and at the edges of the new city. John Hartsock.
We're looking at probably at least one large regional active park, but then because of the terrain, there'll be a lot of natural and open space type parks. And we're looking at them spread kind of throughout the entire city area.
A large tract of land located south of Highway 212 could preserve wildlife areas while creating an opportunity for outdoor recreational activities within the Damascus area. Dean Apostle.
The one area that it seems to be almost universal agreement is that we use this opportunity, all this public investment that's coming in, to establish what we call the big park, which would be south of the highway, where you get to the Clackamas Bluffs and the Three Canyons. And it's an area where Metro has already purchased quite a bit of land. Metro Open Space is down on the Clackamas River floodplain. There's a lot of conservation-minded citizens who live in that area. They don't want to see that area urbanized. We've got spotted owl living in that area right now. We've got a lot of salmon. There's significant amounts of old-growth trees in that area.
The Damascus concept plan now moves on to the next step, the comprehensive plan. It will take approximately 2 years to finalize. But for Diana Lobo, this process is just as important as the outcome.
What I'm hoping the comprehensive plan, public involvement plan, will include is a broad diversity of residents and businesses that will be represented in a way that they can make decisions or assist in the decision-making process in a collaborative way, because I think this is such a wonderful laboratory for creating a new community that it's essential that the residents be able to be involved in a meaningful way.
For the Whole Communities Radio Project, this is Becca Bartleson.
So that's a little setup there about what's going on in Damascus. So now we're joined by Dean Apostle and Diana Lobo, who you just heard in the piece, and then Stephen Metzler, who is the only non-Damascus resident we have on the panel today. And we're doing a follow-up on a discussion we had back in July before the concept plan was accepted. And there was actually, I think it was the day before, there was a meeting in Oregon City to kind of discuss the issues and look at some of the challenges, I guess, that we're facing, the kinds of development that are happening in Damascus. So I want to start by talking about why Damascus, and then we'll look at some of the other issues, including some of the transportation issues, the issue about density versus sprawl, and also protecting the natural resources that are there. But to begin with, I'll have Diana start, since you were part of the committee for the future of Damascus. So it looks like you've been thinking about the future of Damascus for a while. Why is Damascus faced with the challenge of urbanizing? After, and I'm glad you just start by describing what Damascus is now and where it's heading.
Well, that's a little bit of a tall order. Damascus is a beautiful, pretty much pastoral area right now. There are small farms, there's a lot of nursery businesses, which is, of course, the primary industry in Clackamas County. We've got volcanic buttes scattered throughout the area, and its proximity to Portland is the driving factor for its becoming urbanized, being included in the urban growth boundary in 2002, which then fell out of that decision all of the state land use laws that are required for concept plan development and being included in an urban area. We need to accommodate urban growth, and that is both residential and business. We are aiming at certain targets for residential density and job development, both of which are significantly, substantially different from what we have now. Damascus, for the most part, has been a bedroom community for some time for Portland, where there weren't enough jobs in the area to support
the people who live there. People choose to live there because it's beautiful, and it's readily accessible to Mount Hood and Clackamas River and all kinds of wonderful places for recreation and rejuvenation, and it's a wonderful place to live. And now we have a challenge before us to keep it a wonderful place to live.
Well, actually, one of the unusual things about Damascus, and it used to not be so unusual, it used to be one of a countless number of little rural communities that were within a 20-minute drive from Portland. It's the only one left. But it also seems to me one of the challenges at Damascus, you described it as a bedroom community, and it seems that for a very long time, Damascus really hasn't had an identity of its own, other than it's a place where people live and they identify, we live here. I wonder what kind of community is there, and when most of the people in Damascus are driving elsewhere on a daily basis to earn their living. And why don't you answer that, Dean?
Well, to a great extent, I'd say there wasn't much of a community there until we were sort of forced to become a community to defend ourselves against the urbanization. Historically, Damascus was really just kind of a crossroads, and it never developed into a full-fledged town. Boring, which is close by, about 2 miles to the east, was a bit more of a town, although it never incorporated, but it was on the railroad. And
but Boring is not incorporated either?
Boring is a non-incorporated town.
Even though they have a fire department and
school. Well, the fire department covers the whole area, so it covers Damascus and Boring. It's a special district. Yeah, it's a special district.
So the only city out in your area actually then would be Sandy, the nearest city.
Well, Gresham and Happy Valley are adjacent to Damascus. Gresham on the north and Happy Valley on the west, and then Sandy is a bit further to the east. Yeah. So there wasn't much of a community, and Marcia and I talk about this all the time, that we've been sort of forced to become a community, and we've gotten to know our neighbors, and people like Diana, we've become good friends with a lot of our neighbors in trying to envision what our future would be, as not as a rural area, but as more of an urban area.
Well, it's kind of an irony, I guess, that there are a lot of these little rural pockets around Portland that don't have any identity as a community. And I know even in the city that, I mean, I've lived in a couple neighborhoods that got really strongly identified in terms of started to find their own community because they were perceived to being attacked from the outside with development that they didn't want. So it does seem like a lot of our community building comes in the face of adversary as opposed to it being something that organically comes. I'm interested in looking at this process of creating a community from a bunch of diverse people living in scattered farms and scattered little rural residential dwellings. How does that shape what are you shaping out of that, and what kind of community are people envisioning now? Are you still trying to keep a foothold in the rural identity that Damascus has? Is that possible to preserve in the face of what's happening all around you? You mentioned the two cities. I forgot that Gresham and Happy Valley are two cities. I have a hard time thinking of them as cities. I think of them as sprawling suburbs with not a whole lot of identity in either one of those places either. So how do you keep Damascus from becoming another Happy Valley, let's say?
Well, that's a pretty high priority for myself personally, and I, from everything that we've seen in terms of surveys and public opinion, that seems to be a high priority for the public as well. There is a Damascus history that the Committee for the Future of Damascus tried to support and educate people about in terms of the crossroads, the Barlow Trail, the our own post office in years past, and in the 50s there were various Damascus activities that, you know, sort of put Damascus on the map, the candle for the state centenary. But
what's this candle for the state centenary?
Portland was...
It's a big lump of concrete.
It's a little bit more like a pillar. We'll make it look a little bit less lump-like. In the 1950s, when the state of Oregon was celebrating its centennial, Portland was going to put together a candle as a birthday party. Portland couldn't get it together, but the city of Damascus created this concrete candle, which was then lit with actually a gas flame. And there was ceremonies, and there was the governor was there.
Governor Hatfield was there.
And is that lump still there?
The lump is still there in front of the fire station. It would be.
People often ask, what is that?
What in the heck is that thing? It's in beautiful downtown Damascus, and a little signage would be a good thing so that people knew about the history. And I think that's
been part of the challenge when we moved there 13 years ago. You know, it was a lovely place to live, but the history was not anywhere evident, and we had to dig around quite a bit to find the right people who knew what had gone on and to come up with an identity. And it's all there. It's just not necessarily readily available. So we've been working on that part. But to avoid becoming Happy Valley requires, from my perspective, a substantial commitment on the part of the people who live there to say, you know, we want people to be able to live here without being on top of each other. We want people to be able to live here who have a range of physical ability and a range of economic income and a range of perspective. And we want to integrate business into our community in a healthy and sustainable way, as opposed to having residences on top of each other and then a business district, which Happy Valley has had to incorporate or annex business areas in order to keep their tax base semi-sound. And we want to have a more integrated community that will have business and residents and natural resources in an integrated fabric that is sustainable.
Well, it seems that most of the towns, I'm thinking about all the little rural enclaves that have been urbanized around Portland, Happy Valley being one of them, Sunnyside, which I don't think it's not incorporated, is it?
That's correct.
It's just a space.
Clackamas,
yeah. And then on the west side, there's Bonnie Slope and Cedar Mill and all these other little places. And the way the development seems to be happening, as well as in Gresham, which actually was once a rural enclave with a very small center, and in particularly in Beaverton, Hillsborough, Aloha, and Gresham, what seems to be developing is you've got these massive apartment complexes going up on what were once country lanes, which become four-lane boulevards with lots of traffic and no parking and no walking. And then you have the commercial center is a mall, huge malls, that you have to drive to. And even Happy Valley, which is like the scale is a lot smaller than other places, they still have the mall over here and the housing development over there. And I don't think they have as many apartments.
They don't allow any commercial at all in the bowl of Happy Valley, which is the historic center.
Yeah, no commercial.
No commercial.
The old
yeah.
suburban model of like we want to have our residents in one place and our commercial and another. And then the industrial or the business parks are someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see it being different? Well, first of all, why is that not appealing to you? I mean, some people might like this. I mean, I speak as somebody who's either lived out in the country or lived in the city, and I don't get that suburban model at all. But some people really like it. Obviously, it's been working for large communities for the last 40, 50 years. Why is not what you don't want in Damascus? Or is that what's going to happen in Damascus?
Well, we don't know yet. And if the market default is basically what you just described. That's what the market will build. That's what the banks will finance. That's what people are used to building. And, you know, from the end of World War II onward, we've been a car-dominant society, and we've separated land uses. And so we've gotten, you know, really good at building, you know, strip developments and malls and big boxes. And, you know, the whole system is kind of geared towards that. So what some of us in Damascus are trying to do, and I don't use the universal we because we don't know who we are yet. The planning process, yes, we've had maybe 100 people who have been real engaged in it out of 9,000 that live there, and then we've probably got another 600 or 700 or 800 that I think are real well-informed that have come to a lot of the meetings. And then you've got sort of a mystery, which is, you know, maybe amounts to, you know, 8,000 people or so that we don't really know where they're going to be at. And we do know that there's a real tension between the idea of having a, you know, at the risk of scaring any listeners who might be out there in Damascus, a European-style city versus, you know, an American-style sprawl. And this is an experiment. We don't know that we're going to be able to pull this off. New towns where they've been developed have mostly been economic failures. I mean, 90% of new towns probably are economic failures. And the metro, Portland Metro, is, you know, putting a lot of eggs in the Damascus basket, but there isn't really the money to pay for the infrastructure to make this thing work. And so it's a real mystery as to how it's going to come out. But the basic idea is to design Damascus as more of a pre-war type town, which has narrower streets, which has more integrated neighborhoods, has a bit higher density than you would normally find in the suburbs, has land uses more integrated, stores that you could walk to as opposed to have to drive to, that sort of thing. Whether we're going to be, it's one thing to draw it on a piece of paper, and it's another thing to actually make it happen. Put it that way.
Well, we'll get to that in the last part of the show, the actual problems of making these plans into reality. I'm talking with Dean Apostle and Diana Lobo, who are both Damascus residents and been very involved in planning, well, in helping Damascus become an incorporated city as opposed to just one of these amorphous places on a map with those little signs that don't, all they say is Damascus. I remember that sign says just Damascus, as opposed to population, altitude, and all the other things that show that you actually become incorporated. And also with Stephen Metzler, who is a landscape architect and planner. And I want to bring you into the conversation now, Stephen, to talk some about, you've been involved on the advisory committee, right, that's part of Coalition for Liberal Future.
I've been with the Natural Resources Technical Team, which is part of Metro's effort for Damascus. There were very many people involved in this effort. We had natural resources, housing, transportation. We looked at many of the different features to try to really get an integrated effort to really create a livable community. And I think one thing that's really important to look at in all this is that I think we really took the wrong tact after World War II. We went to a way of living that was really designed by engineers for cars, and we've gone away from designing communities for people. And I think the really important thing for communities like Damascus is that we get back to designing communities for people. And like Dean's talking about, that's looking at walkability. That's looking at being able to walk 5 minutes and get to a store, off your office to work, a transit stop to get somewhere else. And, the way the conventional suburban development is designed now, you really have to get into your car to do anything. And I think it just doesn't work. And as the price of oil goes up, it's really going to be difficult for most of these conventional suburban sprawl developments to survive. And we really need an alternative that is more livable. And I think if we look back to American history, the kind of places people want to live in are small towns, pre-World War II small towns, and inner city neighborhoods where you've got density, but it's the kind of density that it's livable. You know your neighbors, and you really have a community. And I think that's what we're lacking now in post-World War II communities. You really don't have that kind of sense of community.
Well, another thing I think that's really critical about Damascus is the land that it's on. I mean, I know as somebody who's been driving through Damascus and stopping there for little supplies on my way to Mount Hood or my way to Sandy, where I lived out there for many, many years, and I have a certain attachment to, there's a lot of parts, sort of the funkiness of it, that it was this little scattering of kind of working class, rural, residential. It didn't have McMansions. It was amazing that it was so close to Portland, and yet it was just this little pocket of real people. But also, there's just this beautiful countryside all around it. So how does that get protected? Because Cedar Mill is another example of, there's really beautiful woods and these incredible wooded hillsides that have all been clear cut by the Peter Courts, and now there are all these kind of packed, expensive homes and shopping malls and other things, and there's threat of a Walmart going in there. How can you protect the natural resources in Damascus?
One of the things that the advisory committee worked so assiduously for, and not necessarily with unanimity, but is butte protection. And there are various ideas about what butte protection actually consists of, but one of the dominant themes that I think needs to be landed on repeatedly is that we not only want to build communities for people, we want to design them for people and not cars. We also need to design them with the landscape, not over the landscape, not oppressing the landscape, not taking the bulldozers that are lined up along Sunnyside Road and clear cutting the trees and taking down the lava domes, but to work with what we have there, which is gorgeous and needs to be protected. So the Butte tops have some protection, although there's already development there, and you know we're not going to take that away. But the steep slopes, we've been trying to, the advisory committee recommended that that area between like 15 and 25% slope be prohibited from development so that it doesn't wash into the valleys and we have more California. And that's, those are the pieces that are really important to maintain, along with the riparian areas and the, there, because there's water all over the place. There was just a clear cut of a wetlands, 2 months ago?
Something yeah, it's like been that. Happening over the last 2 months.
Yeah, and, you know, this is, that can happen now because the city council does not have all of the laws and ordinances in place yet to prevent that. So
or any.
Or any, yeah. So there's a lot of that kind of you know, nuts and bolts on the ground work that needs to happen in order to implement any of the recommendations from the advisory committee for the concept plan, much less, you know, moving into the comprehensive plan. So there's a lot of real nitty-gritty stuff that needs to happen.
Well, actually, before we continue, I need to be legal for a second and let listeners know that you're listening to KDOA Portland listener-sponsored community radio at 90.7 in the Portland metro area, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge, and 100.7 in the Mid-Willamette Valley. And we're talking today about Damascus, a small community on the southeast outskirts of Portland, which is about to be transformed from a sleepy rural residential community to a one of the largest cities in Oregon, actually, a city that would be
top 10.
Yeah, be almost as large as Gresham. And this is a plan that could happen in the next 20 years. The plan has actually gone from, it's finished its concept phase. It's now going to go into its planning stage, the comprehensive plan, and we're talking about that today. And if you want to join in the conversation, the number to call is 503-231-8187. I'm talking with Dean Apostle and Diana Lobo, who are both Damascus residents and have been involved with developing the concept plan, and Stephen Metzler, who is Portland-based?
That's right.
Urban planner and architect who's been working with Metro Council on Damascus issues. It's about 1.5 minutes after 8 o'clock here on KBOO, and you are welcome to give a call if you are a Damascus resident or if you are just concerned about the impact of what kinds of development happens in Damascus, how that is going to actually impact the rest of the region. Give a call at 503-231-8187. Diana, you said something I want to just kind of follow up on before Dean jumps in with his thought. You mentioned you're not going to be doing what they do in California, and you alluded to something I think a lot of Oregonians don't know, that throughout Contra Costa County, which is a very hilly area, much akin to the Damascus area, they did, in fact, level the tops of buttes and fill in the valleys to try to make Contra Costa County look like the Central Valley. And it's a very, I was out there a bunch when they were in the process of doing that. It's a very strange process. And in fact, the Greenbelt Alliance folks showed me a map, it was an aerial map of all these buttes that have been leveled. So we don't, I mean, we're not doing that here in Oregon, but we are doing something else that is, it has the same effect. I mean, just west of you guys is the series of buttes just east of 82nd Street and basically west of Damascus. It's a whole series of buttes, particularly the one at the end of Johnson Creek Boulevard, which are being built on, and those are like 30% grade, maybe they're really steep.
It's Mount Scott.
Right, the Mount Scott area, but it's actually, Mount Scott isn't getting built on as much as the little buttes right around Mount Scott.
No, Mount Scott's been built on very heavily, actually. Yeah. And so is Mount Talbot, which is the one to the south.
Right, that's what I'm thinking of. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And Mount Scott at least has a cemetery. It's going to keep it from being totally developed. But what's actually happened as a result of that development, a lot of the top of those buttes have gone down into the valleys.
Yeah.
In fact, they've washed down Crystal Springs, where I live, so it's gone all the way down to the Willamette. So let's talk a little bit about how the pressures to do that kind of development in Damascus, and how do you keep that from happening?
Go for it.
Okay, I guess I'm on. This is Dean. They're actually, what you were just describing in California, there are some folks in Damascus that propose exactly the same thing for the buttes, which is to terrace them and build on them and, you know, no reason to save them, really. There's plenty of open space around. So we're not by any means out of the woods yet on that issue. The advisory committee did develop an idea, and it's only an idea at this point because the concept plan has no real force of law. It's until things get rezoned, we really don't know what the outcome will be. But what we settled on was a kind of a three-part land use system, which has high-intensity urban development on the valley floors. Then it has sort of a transition zone on the lower slopes of the buttes, which allow cluster development. But much of the area would be undeveloped. About 80% would be left undeveloped, and about 20% would be developed. And then as you move further up into the buttes, you get much less development, mostly kind of infill on existing lots of record. And if somebody had a 40-acre patch of forest that they've been managing for timber production, they would be able to cut that down into 4 10-acre properties. So there would be some development allowed, but it wouldn't be intensive urban development like you've seen in California up in the hills. So the valley floors would have the brunt of the urban development, and there'd be stream corridors and wetlands and things like that preserved in the valley floors and kind of traditional parks, but the open space conservation would be concentrated in the hills.
And do you think that's a plan that would be workable?
Well, I think one of the key concepts of this whole effort was to really have the buttes and the stream corridors as an integrated network of habitat, where you provide for wildlife migration. You need larger areas for animals to really survive. But a really key part of this whole thing is the stream corridors. I mean, there is so much diversity of wildlife that both lives in those corridors and travels throughout those. And also the stream corridors are very important as salmon habitat, which is a key icon in the Northwest. And to really preserve those habitats, both freshwater and terrestrial, a lot of the stream corridors really need to be protected. So that's a major element. And the plan really started with those two elements, the stream corridors and the buttes, as the backbone. And everything else was developed kind of around that. So that's a major, major point.
We actually have a caller, and if you want to join the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. We'll take our first caller. Hello, you're on the air. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello. If I had a decent income and transportation, I would be living in the country someplace. But I have to live in the city because I do not. I'm interested to know, do you have in your area, I guess you say Damascus, do you have any poor people there, any homeless people? And also I sense you probably would not want any type of public transportation there, like a train or a bus. I will listen to you. Goodbye.
Okay, thanks for calling. Well, actually, that jumps us ahead a little bit, but we'll answer this question and then go back and talk more about natural resources. What are the plans both for having a diverse array of incomes in Damascus, and what kind of transit are you hoping to have?
First of all, there are poor people in the area now. I myself qualified for the earned income tax credit last year, I can proudly say. So I consider myself among the poor, but not quite homeless.
I've seen Dean's house, so I can attest that.
It's almost homeless, yeah. Thanks a lot. The second part of your question was what's going to be done in the future as far as transit. It's a split, again, in the community. But I would say that those of us that have been most involved in the planning have been very supportive of having a transit system. In fact, we're quite disappointed when the plans did not call for extension of light rail or trolley systems to Damascus. Although they allowed for the possibility that in the future, the economics of doing it just didn't seem to pan out. How much lower income housing there would be or subsidized housing, this is a problem throughout the state of Oregon. It won't be unique to Damascus. Every city in the Portland metropolitan area has numerical goals for low-income housing. Damascus will probably have some goals developed, which will be comparable to what other suburban cities have. The bigger question for all of us is not so much the lower-income housing. It's probably going to be the moderate-income housing. You're ending up with a big hole kind of in the center where you can get, if you can get subsidized housing, that's great. If you can afford expensive housing, that's great. But there isn't much left in between. And I think that's going to be, given that the infrastructure costs at Damascus are going to be so high, are our cost of new housing is probably going to be the highest in the Portland metropolitan area. We're going to be up in Lake Oswego land. And, in fact, the only way we're going to pay for that infrastructure is to have a very expensive city. So the idea that we're going to have a lot of low-income housing or even moderate-income housing there is probably not going to happen.
Well, that doesn't probably sit well with a whole lot of social justice activists, including probably those who live in Damascus. So what is that, just a given that Damascus, we're going to be creating Lake Oswego East, or is there any other way to try to address, well, the problem, which was actually, there was an article in the Oregonian a couple of weeks ago about that, about how expensive the infrastructure costs are. Is there any way to offset that besides just creating a very expensive pool of housing?
Well, I think one key is really to have a diversity of housing. And the way we do things now, we have large houses on large lots, and then we have big apartment complexes, and that's pretty much it. But if you look at the older neighborhoods that we're trying to, again, emulate, you have things like you have accessory buildings in the back, a garage apartment, say, that someone with a lower income could rent. That would provide housing for someone with less income, but also provide a source of income for the homeowner in front. That's one idea. Another idea is to for people to live in a two-story building. They could live in the top story and rent out the lower story. That's another way to supplement your income and provide housing for people.
So you're talking about like duplexes?
Things like that, yeah. But again, we don't do it that much in this country, but I mean, you can really, you can serve both people who rent, who don't have a high enough income to buy a house, but also help people who are owning a house to really be able to pay for it.
The state of Oregon land use system requires every city to allow for up to 50% attached housing. And that's one way to prevent what they call exclusionary zoning, where you had communities like Lake Oswego that would keep apartments basically out. I'm not saying Lake Oswego did, but basically higher income communities tended to do that. So Damascus will have to allow for quite a bit of higher density housing. The question is whether that higher density housing would be quote-unquote, you know, low- to moderate-income housing. And I'm just not convinced that it will be. I mean, look at the Pearl District. I mean, that's high density, but it's not low- to moderate-income. The low- to moderate-income in the Pearl District has to be subsidized. And the question is, where do the subsidies come from? And we don't know that. We don't know where that would come from. Damascus, we're going to be so busy paying for infrastructure, we're not going to have, I don't think, anything left to provide much in the way of subsidies for keeping, you know, rents low and that sort of thing.
Well, the subsidies, I think, in the Pearl District came from the Portland Development Commission. So is there any plans for creating anything like that out in Damascus? Or are there any means for the county or any?
The county won't be involved. I think that, and, you know, the idea of having an urban renewal district wouldn't make much sense because, I mean, really, what are we? You know,
rural renewal district.
Exactly. And so what they're able to do in places like where they use urban renewal is they're able to capture part of the increase in the tax revenue and then apply that, you know, within the district for subsidized housing and infrastructure costs and things.
You could do an urban renewal district around the Bi-Mart.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, we probably could do an urban renewal district there, but it would be pretty limited. But where the center city of Damascus is currently planned for, which is in your setup piece where we were standing on 232nd and Highway 212, where the wetland was clear cut that Diana was talking about, that area is, you know, it's basically a greenfield. There's a few houses there. The lot sizes tend to be very large. There's 50-acre, you know, patches in there. And so we're going to be going from a greenfield, which, you know, a few years ago before the urban growth boundary decision was made, that land might have been worth $10,000 to $20,000 an acre at the high end. Is going to be worth somewhere between $200,000 and $400,000 an acre once you have infrastructure, sewer and water in there and are able to develop it. So how would you capture some of that increase in value and apply that to subsidized housing, to parks and all those different things? And those are questions that remain to be answered.
Well, actually, I know there's been some discussions and possibly some ballot measures proposed that would basically apply a windfall tax. So if somebody is making a great boom by having their property be incorporated into the urban growth boundary and their property values go up 10 or 20 times, that there should be some taxation on that. And I think this has been discussed over and over and over again, but I don't think it's a reality anywhere in Oregon.
It's also too late for that in Damascus because the urban growth decision was already made. Where that's being talked about is future urban growth boundary expansions. This one's kind of a done deal, and so.
But I don't understand why you couldn't still. The property values haven't gone up yet, have they?
Yeah, they already have. They're already starting to, but not. I mean, they're going to go up a lot more once the infrastructure.
Well, let's say you do the infrastructure the ways that you pay for the infrastructure. I'm not an urban planner. I'm just making this stuff up the top of my head. So Stephen, you should jump in and kind of get me in place if I'm too far out. But my thought would be if, as you're creating the infrastructure and the property values then really start to go up, that you are taxing on the increase in the property value, and that's also sort of paying for the infrastructure as it's going in. Is that a realistic?
It's kind of the old Henry George approach, isn't it? The land tax, as it used to be called back in, the 1890s. But, yeah, there is some talk about that. I don't know that that's going to happen in Damascus. I think there'd be a lot of resistance to it. You know, it gets back to what Diana had said earlier, that, people that live out there didn't even want this to begin with. And now they would be, they're going to have to pay for the privilege. So it's kind of difficult to do that retroactively. It'll happen.
Yeah, thinking of paying for the privilege, it reminds me of in the 70s and the early 80s when East County was being annexed to Portland and everybody suddenly had to get on the sewer line. And I remember being rather outraged that these people were being hit with $3,000, $4,000 sewer bills. And that was then. I mean, now it would be a lot more money. And it was like they didn't want to be annexed. They liked their kind of, hardly call it rural residential out there, but it was just kind of this low-level, funky sprawl. And they liked having the space, and they just sort of were pretending they were living out in the country out there on 147th Street or wherever. And they really didn't want to have to pay for those sewer link-ups. And it alienated a lot of those people to the existing Portland city government and also to the county government. However, this seems to be a little bit different because this is where people are not, their property values are going up an awful lot. People in East County, I don't think their property values went up that much. They just were hit with big bills. But here, if there was a way for people to start changing consciousness so they had more of a collectivist attitude and they understood that they are getting a huge financial benefit by what's happening, that don't they owe something to the community and to helping provide for the infrastructure that's giving them this huge economic benefit. So it isn't like so much after the fact, as you're saying. And it's also not hitting them with just a bill because it's hitting them with a bill on a huge income that they're going to be potentially generating.
I think it's possible that something like that can happen. I mean, one of the things is that in Damascus, about 75% of the people that live there are like Diana. They have maybe 1 acre or less, and they're not going to stand to benefit from increased property values vis-a-vis development. I mean, their property would go up about the same. Regardless of whether it's urbanized or not. People like myself who have 5 acres or more are the ones that are going to get most of the economic benefits, and to the extent that we have to pay for the privilege, I think that's appropriate.
So, I mean, you're a good example of somebody who, you stood on your property with me a few weeks ago and you said, whatever happens, I'm going to make a lot of money. But, I mean, speak for yourself, Dean, are you willing to pay for the ability to make so much money?
Yes.
Okay, so you could be a role model.
But I don't want to be the only volunteer.
I understand that. We do have a caller. If you want to join the conversation this morning, give a call at 503-231-8187. I'm talking with Dean Apostle and Diana Lobo, who are Damascus residents who've been involved with helping to shape a plan that's going to transform Damascus from a sleepy rural residential enclave at the edges of Portland to one of the 10 largest cities in Portland, supposedly in the next 20 years, right? And then also with Stephen Metzler, who is a Portland-based urban planner and architect working with Metro Counselor to help these folks in Damascus figure out what they're going to be doing. And if you want to join the conversation, give a call at 503-231-8187. It's about 19 minutes after 8 o'clock here on Kibu Community Radio. Hello, you're on the air.
I'd like to comment on the issues raised around how to generate revenue for these purposes. And it always seems like it comes back to the same issue, and that is when you stratify income and wealth in society, you end up with exactly the problems we've got. And I think it just boils down to, if the wealthier and higher income people cannot be taxed adequately or refuse to be, you know, that's where you end up. I mean, that's your parameter that pretty much gets you or doesn't get you where you want to go. And I think just in the last 25 years since Reagan, when you bring those top tax rates down from almost 90% down into the 20 percentile area, and then you see a huge increase in wealth and income, Bill Gates and the like, that's just a tremendous amount of financial resource that doesn't get tapped above and beyond the fact that some foundations, you know, contribute some amount voluntarily. And so government ends up constantly being underfunded. So, you know, I think this has got to be kind of a correction back to some middle ground between 20-some-odd percent and 90%.
Okay.
That's my comment.
Okay, thanks for calling.
I think the National Security Agency needs to get a tap on that collar. It's a very un-American proposal.
Yeah,
they probably already do.
Right, yeah. And they're probably testing for radiation inside of cells, too. I don't think we're going to spend a lot of time talking today about redistribution of wealth, because I think it is overall in the picture part of what makes it so hard for a community like Damascus to develop along its own destiny. But I'd rather stay in the dreamland today and let's talk about what this destiny is that you're trying to decide. And I want to get back to the natural resource issues. And let's talk about the big park that is being talked about for along the bluff above the Clackamas River. And let's talk about now, like, because some of the things that are being touted, I know Stephen and also Mike Houck have talked about the possible benefits, actually, for wildlife protection and wildlife corridors and long-term protection by actually urbanizing Damascus and then set aside some habitat that would actually be protected. Is this, well, let's talk about what needs to be protected, what can be protected, and how realistic is it that this may actually enhance some wildlife protection?
Well, I think you have to start with the fact that you can't protect everything. And you have to focus on what's really most beneficial, both to the environment, to nature, and to society and people. And that's where you get into the idea of protecting pieces that already have the most diversity, the most number of species, that are the most sensitive areas. And you have to look at the fact that this is the Damascus area is a piece of a regional network of environmental areas. And one thing we looked at in Damascus is not just protecting features within the Damascus area, but also looked at connections over to the Sandy River, up to Powell Butte, those kind of larger areas, to the Willamette River via the Clackamas River. So I think, again, I'll get back to the idea that the stream corridors really are very important, and having large features like the buttes are as well. One way you can integrate human habitat with natural habitat is to look at this idea of having more dense development, and not to scare people off, if you look at density, not as big downtown Portland, but again, you're looking at kind of small town densities, inner city neighborhood type densities with smaller lots and that kind of thing.
So actually, let's think of a small town that's close by. I mean, Sandy, Oregon, the old part of Sandy actually was fairly dense, and but there are small houses on small lots, basically.
Yeah, and I think that's what's really workable. I mean, we got into a strange thing with large lots and cars after World War II, and I think really this development of having neighborhoods is key. You really need a neighborhood where it's walkable and you know your neighbors. So I think that's really important to look at that as the key feature. But if you look at denser development, but also integrated with a natural environment, you can do things like along the stream corridors, you can have small organic plots where people can have community gardens. You could have small, not by law now, but if you change Oregon law, you could have small commercial organic farms, things like that. That would provide nature, or at least open space, within the communities and kind of integrate a kind of a rural feel to the community and with the stance development. So that's kind of having the best of both worlds if you do that.
Also, I'm interested in some of the pieces of land that would be protected. And I know, Dean, you're a little bit skeptical about how well all this will work. But let's talk about the bluff area above the Clackamas River. This is, as you're, if you were following Highway 224 towards Eagle Creek and Estacada, on your left rises this really nice bluff. And this is another road I know really well, but I've never been anywhere on that bluff. There's not really any way that I know of to get there. And it's one of those places that I've always wanted to explore, but felt like, well, it's I don't know if it's all private property. I don't know who owns it, but it doesn't seem like it's something that, well, first of all, that I personally can experience. And secondly, I fear if it's owned privately that someday it'll all be developed. So what is the status of that bluff, and how could that be protected as part of this plan?
Well, one really good news piece that is recent is that there's the Pratt family, I always have to remember where the consonant is, it's not exactly a donation. I'm not sure that the term, and if you can remember the term, Dean, please help me out.
Conservation easement.
A conservation easement for a huge chunk. I think it's 30 or 40 acres or more.
It's about 38, I think.
38 yeah. Acres of land in that exact area that you're talking about, and that is into perpetuity. It's a relationship that they've developed with the Three Rivers Conservancy that has set this land aside to not be developed. They're very specific about that it would not be developed. It's not accessible to the public at this point. It may or may not be in the future, but what that provides for the community at large is this incredible geographic area that includes a wonderful range of both flora and fauna species that are indigenous and use this area as their habitat and will be available into perpetuity. So that's really exciting. There are other people along that bluff, along the river, who have been approached about this kind of idea. There are other people along that bluff who, you know, have plans for golf courses and McMansions. So, you know, there's clearly attention there, but there has been work done in that area to preserve both environmentally and visually the beauty that's there, and this is within the, actually some of it is outside of the UGB and some of it is inside, but at the edge there of the boundary, it's a beautiful place that we can, it seems to me this is a seed, and we can nurture this seed. And we can see it be, you know, paved over. So the balance of action, it seems to me, falls in the court of the people who have concerns and desires to see this place, the big park, become a reality, become an active park where people can be as well as a habitat for wildlife. And that means people have to be involved, and that whether they live there or whether they're recreationists or conservationists or whatever, they have to be involved.
Well, 38 acres, I mean, compared to Forest Park, which is about 2,000 acres, is a pretty small piece of property on such a large, I mean, that area potentially is a lot more than 2,000 acres, I would think.
It's probably 4,000 to 5,000 acres in the area, and of that, about 800 acres is currently in public ownership. Metro, in the 1995 or 96 bond measure, targeted the Clackamas River floodplain greenway, and they've purchased quite a bit of land, including some farms that they may, you know, be restoring back to natural habitat eventually. There's also a county-owned property, 40 acres, called the Madrone Wall, and it used to be a very popular rock climbing area. It's about a 200-foot-high vertical kind of red rock. It's a very interesting, fascinating area. That's an area, Barbara, where you could have pulled off the road and actually gone into because it's publicly owned, although it's posted, I think, no trespassing. for various reasons that I won't get into. And there's been a lot of work being done by a group, Madrone Wall Preservation Committee, to try and get the county commissioners to not open that area to rock quarrying, which was the reason they purchased it some years ago. And the signs are that they're probably not going to be quarrying it. It'll probably become part of a larger park system. Also, Metro in their proposed bond measure for 2006 has targeted, my understanding, Steve, maybe you know more than I do, my understanding is that they've targeted the what we call the big park area, the Clackamas Bluffs and Canyons, for significant amount or emphasis within that next bond measure. So there is a good chance, and there's also some state park interest in the area as well. The Casdero Trail goes through Deep Creek Canyon, and so state park is actually involved in there too, and so we could end up with a state park or a regional park.
So there's potentially there could be a park that's 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 acres?
Potentially, but the thing I want to emphasize to follow up on what Stephen had said earlier, when we map these corridors and protected areas, et cetera, these are areas that are already there. We're not creating them new. We may draw a line around them and prevent more development from happening in there, but we're not really going to make the habitat any better than it is now. The exception would be on the valley floors where you've got streams that have been heavily impacted by agriculture. In those cases, if we establish a protected zone around those streams and then we do some restoration within that zone, you could actually get an improvement in habitat and water quality. But for the most part, most of the habitat we have, it's stuff that is already existing. We're going to be chipping away at it. We're not going to be adding to it.
Well, I think that's understood, but I think the other part is that there's an awful lot of chipping away that happens, more destructive that happens without any kind of planning. And I know that where I used to live up in Sandy, in a way less developed area than Damascus, that there were some nasty practices that people were doing that weren't being controlled. This was actually before the land use laws actually were codified. But I lived near Tickle Creek, and yeah. I mean, there was some strange stuff. I used to ride my horse down there, and I now knowing what I know now, there was a huge amount of erosion that was going on there. I don't know. There was a talk. Actually, there was a dirt bike trail there for a while. I mean, you know, there was some bad stuff. And a lot more bad stuff, I think, was allowed in those areas in the 70s in Oregon than it's allowed now. But there's always a possibility when things aren't codified that there'll be at least unofficial dirt bike tracks or other things that could really cause problems.
But we may still have all that, too, except with more people using them, so we just don't know yet.
Well, I think one key that is not just looking at the protected areas themselves, but, again, is looking at how we develop next to them. And one thing we haven't talked about is this idea of green infrastructure, which really is a way of development that is very different from conventional suburban development now. Now we have very wide streets. We have, again, designed by engineers. We have houses that have very big lots and a lot of big lawns with a lot of pesticides and herbicides applied to them. What we can do is develop these differently. We can have things like skinny streets, which not only have less impervious cover, but also are safer for pedestrians, bicyclists, that kind of thing. And, things like detention ponds on site. You can use buffer areas along streams to retain water. There are a lot of ways, even green, eco-roofs, green roofs. There are ways to prevent a lot of the runoff, which is destroying the natural areas, the streams, right now. So I think that's a really important part of what we're looking at for Damascus, is looking at a new way of development, which is much less destructive of the environment.
Well, I know that a few weeks ago the concept plan was passed. What kind of percentage of support amongst the people who were at the meeting did it pass by, would you say?
Well, maybe Diana, you should chip in here too, but at the October 8th forum, people weren't asked to support or not support the concept plan as such. They were asked to support or not support various elements of the concept plan. And then there was a couple of meetings of the advisory committee, and things got very hot because a group that is pushing for more development, particularly in the Buttes, showed up in fairly large numbers and got the attention of the advisory committee. But fortunately, we're not able to convince the advisory committee to weaken the protection of the Buttes. So when you ask what's the support, I would say, in my sense, and Diana, you need to pitch in here, but my sense is that the community is not very supportive of this concept plan, but the reason is because it's too much development. I think most people that live in the community were hoping for a smaller urban footprint. I think they were hoping for more green space. I think they were hoping for a farm conservation plan, which we don't have. And so I don't get the sense that this plan is a compromise, and I don't get the sense that it has a lot of enthusiastic support.
Well, I'm curious what happens now, because if you don't have that much support and most people in Damascus really want to keep it the way it is, then how do you prevent it from going the way of Happy Valley, which was this person sold their land and that person sold their land, this person over there sold the land and there was no plan and this is what we have?
I'd like to jump in on that spot. We campaigned for the incorporation of the city of Damascus on the basis of local control. We knew we were going to be urbanized. We knew that that was not something that we could avoid, certainly not in the time frame we had to deal with. But we also knew that we had the possibility to avoid being Happy Valley, to avoid that kind of thoughtless, planless sprawl. And the selling point was local control. At this point, that is exactly where we are. And if we are going to prevent the kinds of things that we are faced with directly to our west and north in terms of Happy Valley and Gresham, that's what we're going to have to do. I agree with Dean. I think that the concept plan is considered a barely acceptable compromise amongst the people who live there. And there is certainly, from my understanding, no clear commitment to it on the part of the city council. And as Dean mentioned earlier, there are no legal teeth in the concept plan. So the comprehensive plan, which will have legal teeth, is the place for people to put their energy and attention, because that's where the rubber hits the road. We have the potential, and the advisory committee talked at length about having design standards, things like Stephen was talking about, where there's eco-roofs and green design standards. There are, of course, within the advisory committee as well as within the community as a whole, a range of perspectives as to whether or not that's a good idea. Vociferous advisory committee member thought that any green development was just over the edge and just too far out there. But I believe that he is in the minority in terms of Damascus residents. Now, whether or not he's in the minority in terms of the Damascus City Council is another story, but I think it's incumbent upon the residents to be as involved as possible in this process, because It, as Dean pointed out earlier, it's going to be economically driven, and if we don't have the presence of the community in force, organized and vociferous, we're going to be bulldozed over again, and we will end up looking like Happy Valley East, which is not appealing to anybody that I know of. And, I mean, I don't know the whole community. I've only been there 13 years, but there's a clear majority that say, no, that's not what we want.
I want to, on behalf of, you know, all Damascus residents, I want to apologize to our Happy Valley.
I'm waiting to get phone calls from Gresham and Happy Valley.
Well,
I mean,
this is an ongoing thing, and I've become kind of buddies with the mayor of Happy Valley, who we don't share much, you know, my political perspective, but, you know, we are trying to be fair to each other and hear each other. And there's a lot of sensitivity that, you know, among people in Happy Valley, that why do you keep pointing at us saying we screwed things up? You know, we were a rural community that was forced to develop. You're going to go through the same thing. And in 20 years, people are probably going to point at Damascus and say, we don't want to become like that. So be careful who you point fingers at. So I just want to get that out of the way. I want to maybe change the subject just a little bit to talk about Oregon's land use planning system and how that's sort of played out in Damascus, because I think there's some work going on now. The legislature is passed a bill which is called the Big Look, which is, I think, a 2 to 3 year kind of review of the state land use system. And I've been kind of thinking about this a lot based on the Damascus experience, and I want to just maybe throw out a couple of ideas. from this experience. One is that Oregon's land use planning system values conservation of working farm and forest land ahead of habitat, way ahead of habitat. And, you know, as a small farmer, or at least a small farm owner, as I pointed out to you, Barbara, Marcia does all the farming on our place, and I get to watch sometimes. But I'm pro farm conservation. I'm pro working forest conservation, but I'm also pro habitat conservation. And one of the things we really need to do is equalize, I think, as we're thinking about where to expand urban areas, we need to give equal weight to natural resources in terms of habitat as we do to working farms and forests. And the current system doesn't do that.
And, well, that's why Damascus was included.
Correct.
And because the big debate was Damascus versus the St. Mary's
Correct.
Property that was out just west of Beaverton.
Yeah.
And St. Mary's was a working farm, very valuable farmland, flat. The developers were just, much easier to develop. Damascus is a developer's nightmare, which is also one reason why it may take a long time to develop Damascus, because it's not an easy place to develop. There's a reason why it's developed the way it has, which is these little pockets of houses and then separated by challenging wild areas that are very hard to develop. So I think that I think what you're saying, Dean, is really an important thing. And I've talked with many environmentalists in Oregon in the last few years who are sort of up in arms about that aspect of the Oregon land use laws. Well, we'll all celebrate the fact that we don't yet look like Contra Costa County or the Central Valley of California, and hopefully we won't, that the emphasis denies a very, very important part of what not just makes Oregon special, but what makes Oregon a really healthy place is healthy wildlife habitat. Do you see that that's something that Metro Council, Stephen, is looking at and is trying to maybe start to shift the emphasis a little bit?
Well, I think one really important thing that's coming up is this bond issue that Metro has for open space. I think it's very important for people to get behind that, because that really will help provide a natural area environmental backbone for the whole area, not just Damascus. So that's really key. I think that look at Oregon's land use laws. I have to say that it's so much better than other places. My dad has a ranch outside Austin, about 40 minutes away, and it's a beautiful piece of property. But already we're seeing all these little ticky-tack subdivisions popping up everywhere around there. And there's no connection. There's no community. People just want to get in there and develop, and there's no controls, strip malls, that kind of thing. So it's really much better here in Oregon than a lot of places, I have to say that.
Including some of the places that I see on your resume. You worked a lot around the Seattle area and Thurston County. And, I mean, the Seattle area is certainly become one of the largest sprawl areas on the West Coast.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's an example of how not to do things. I mean, Oregon, at least with the urban growth boundaries, with the kind of controls they have, it really is creating a more livable place for all Oregonians.
Well, actually, we've got some more callers, and we've got a few more minutes here. I'm talking this morning with Dean Apostle, who is, I think that the caller is, okay, this sounds better, because we're getting this terrible echo, which I think the caller had their radio on. So, caller, make sure your radio is off before we put you on the air. I'm talking with Dean Apostle and Diane Lobo, who are Damascus residents and been involved with the incorporation of Damascus as a city and trying to create a plan that they to create a community that they'll still want to live in 15 or 20 years hence. And Stephen Metzler, who is an urban designer and architect with Metro Council. And if you want to join the conversation, we've got about another 10 minutes left of the program. You can give a call at 503-231-8187. Hello, you're on the air.
My question is the provision for schools. You know, are there going to be mega schools, big schools, little schools? You know, you hear that in the Pearl District, they take care of that. There are no children. But and the other one is, if you want people to walk, you've got to have sidewalks. And that's my comment.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Schools are a huge issue for us because systems development charges, which are fees that developers pay for the privilege of developing, which pay for certain infrastructure costs like parks and sidewalks and main highways and transportation, State of Oregon is one of the only states in the West that I know of that has no, that does not allow systems development charges for schools. And yet schools are probably the largest public cost, and that cost is going to be borne by the people who live in Damascus, the resident who may not benefit from development at all. They're going to have to pony up money to pay for all the new schools. Whether these are going to be mega schools or how they're going to be distributed is up to the school districts. We actually have three school districts, so we're not just one school district, but we have three in the planning area. I want to follow up, too, on what I was talking about before with the state land use system, if that's okay.
Yeah.
There were two other items that I think need to be improved in the state land use system. One of them is the public involvement component. Public involvement is the first goal in the state land use planning system, which has, I think, 19 total goals. And yet, public involvement is procedural only. In other words, it doesn't really matter what a community wants. 90% of a community could not want to become urban, for example, and Metro can just go ahead and expand the urban growth boundary there anyway, because as long as they have the right number of meetings, as long as they put out the right number of notices, they can completely blow off and ignore the community. And that needs to change. I mean, for example, we have new numerical goals. We have to expand the urban growth boundary to accommodate 20 years worth of projected population growth. So there's fixed numbers that drive urban growth boundary decisions. But there's no number on community involvement. There's no number that says, well, if more than 75% of a community in a referendum does not want to urbanize, therefore they shouldn't have to urbanize. And we need something that, some kind of trigger that allows community involvement to have more than just procedural weight. And another point is Oregon does not have a new towns policy. And the latest projections that I've seen are that we're growing by 40 to 50,000 people per year. So we're basically growing by one new Damascus per year for the next 20 years. And all of that growth is not going to be accommodated in Portland and in the existing communities because there's resistance. I mean, a lot of Portland neighbors, I used to live in Selwood. There was strong resistance in Selwood to increase density. There was strong resistance in Multnomah Village to increase density, and so the city of Portland is only going to take up so much of the new growth, and so we are probably going to need to create more towns like Damascus in other parts of Oregon and other parts of the metropolitan area. But we have no policy for this. The state system has no policy for new towns. Metro has no policy for new towns. We need to have a new town policy. I mean, Europeans have had this for years, and they developed quite a few new towns after the Second World War, particularly Great Britain. And then it requires a significant public investment, particularly in the planning. One of the things that happened in Damascus that got my goat very early on was that we ended up hiring basically a highway engineer to design Damascus. And the reason we hired a highway engineer is because the project was funded. The only funding for the planning was coming from state and federal highway funds. And so ODOT, Oregon Department of Transportation, which was administering those funds, didn't want to have to bother to go through a full request for proposal process. They wanted to hire somebody they already had on the list so they didn't have to take up all their administrative time hiring an actual town architect who knew how to design a town. So we ended up hiring basically a highway engineer. And not that they didn't have any town planning capabilities. They did have some, and I think they did the best with what they had. But it seems to me that, you know, when we've got one town to design in the state of Oregon, and in fact, the only town we've ever actually designed from the state of Oregon before building it, it seems to me we would hire the best possible town architecture team we could find internationally and not, you know, oh, well, we've got this list here with some highway engineers. Let's just pick from this list of three people. That is a big mistake. And we need to have a financing mechanism in place for planning new towns. The burden should not be on the people that are, you know, going to have to suffer the consequences of living there, except for those like myself who have property that, you know, they can develop and then reap some rewards from.
Okay, we got another caller. So, hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I have recently become a volunteer planning commissioner for the city of Mooloolah, and I was wondering if the panel could give me some. It's kind of an overwhelming process because we're redoing comprehensive plan and the code, and we are planning a expansion of the city, and consequently, you know, pretty decent amount of growth in the next 20 years. I'm pretty overwhelmed, and I was wondering if the panel could give me some pointers on what to look for. And I know to preserve open space, and we are going to have a bike walking equestrian trail throughout the community, and but you know it's a tough thing because you have the moneyed interests and you have the interests of the people in the town that kind of want to keep it a small town kind of look. So I was wondering if you could give me some pointers.
Actually, I want to throw out another question too with you because you have a new city council in Damascus. How do you keep your city council from being like most city councils, which is that their major campaign contributions come from real estate and developer interests, and therefore, once they get into office, it's all about real estate. And that used to be true of the Portland City Council until probably the current council we have. And a lot of decisions about Portland development up until the last 5 or 6 years were driven that way. How do you keep that from happening in Damascus? And also, how do you, what recommendations do you have for our caller from Olala?
So a quick comment for your caller. First of all, you have to give up any idea that you might have a life. Now that you're doing this, you're committed. There has been a lot of really good work done. The American Institute of Architects recently, and maybe Stephen might know more about this, the American Institute of Architects recently developed kind of a model code system to be able to steer new development or redevelopment along the lines of what we're talking about and what Stephen was talking about earlier with mixed uses and apartments above stores and smaller lots. And it looks at setbacks. It looks at alleys. It has a model code system that you really ought to try and get a hold of that through the American Institute of Architects. And Stephen, I'll let you comment from there.
I think there are a number of groups that are working on this kind of thing. The past, say, 20 years, there's been a movement called New Urbanism, which is really a reaction to sprawl. And the Congress for New Urbanism is the group that, one group that I've looked at, that it's, if you go online, which is CNU.org, you can get a lot of information about all these ideas about walkable neighborhoods, about mixed use, all those kind of things. This is a good way to start. The ASLA, American Society of Landscape Architects, as Dean mentioned, the American Institute of Architects, they're all groups that have a lot of ideas, but I think this Congress for New Urbanism is a really good place to start, and they have something called the Charter of the New Urbanism, which talks about all these ideas we've looked at today. So that would be a good start.
And you know, to Barbara's comment or question about the real estate interests and stuff, so far in Damascus we haven't seen much evidence of that, and we're still a small enough community where I think somebody can get elected going door to door, and there isn't the major media in Damascus is the Damascus Observer, which I happen to be a cub reporter for. It goes out monthly to every household in the community, and so there isn't a lot of advantage to raising a lot of money for a campaign yet in Damascus. And I imagine the same probably holds true for Malala. What would you do with all the money that you raise? People raise money in politics mainly to buy media time, and there's no media time to buy.
One other point I'd like to make for the caller from Damascus or from Malala is that you might want to check out the International Association for Public Participation. That's the IAP2.org website as another resource for techniques for involving your community so that you have a balance between the moneyed interests that want to develop and the residential or rural or environmental folks who want to keep it more the way it is. There's a lot of tools and techniques that they have at the website just for free that would give you some ideas about how to do that. I want to applaud you for having a planning commission. That's really something I think is going to be essential for Damascus in order to keep that balance of interests. We have yet to develop that, but I have high hopes, and I think that gets back to your question, Barbara, about how do we keep the city council accountable and not in the pocket of developers. Is if we have a Damascus Planning Commission, then we have some balance to whatever purchase there might be of political favors, which I agree with Dean at this point. I think we're not safe from that, but it's less of a threat because there's not the perks available yet. You know, it'll be coming down the road, so we have to keep our eyes open. But we have a little bit of a window here to keep small town politics and go door to door, and we're going to need to be doing it.
Yeah, the next election is really the crucial one. The 2006 Damascus Council is the one that will create the blueprint for Damascus.
Well, we've got about another minute left here on the show. I'm going to give time for one more caller. So, hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I'd like somebody who's going to develop to possibly, like, go to Holland, and if you take the train from Amsterdam to Rotterdam, you can see how attractive the interwoven nature of bikeways and roadways and streetcars can be done, and it can be three-dimensional. I hate all of the stress on the surface and the dangerousness of highways and things like that for pedestrians and cyclists. So somebody needs to start thinking three-dimensional. That's the only good reason to have new development, is there could be some new ideas incorporated. I do want to say I wish somebody would bring a lawsuit against the state and federal government for overgrowing and overdeveloping once livable places like Portland. I felt that Portland, the metro area, has been overpopulated since the 1970s, and that if you look at the overuse and congestion on the state highways and the interstate roads, what you have in effect is non-functionality and no ability to move at will, and somebody should sue for our livability.
Okay, I need to cut you off because I'm just right out of time, and I want to give some time to our guests. So I thank you for calling, and I want to just open up for the last moment here for everybody, just like parting comments.
I moved here in 1978 from Chicago, and I think the door should have been closed right after.
I moved here in 1971. It should have been closed then. Okay.
I moved here in 1963, and I'll give you, a few years.
Well, I think caller, as an idea there, I think you said it when you were talking about the Netherlands, is that there you have a very that's the densest population in Europe, I believe, maybe the world, but they designed it so that it's livable. You have a high density of human development, but you also have the kind of features you're talking about. So that's the key. It's not the number of people necessarily. It's the way you develop.
Yep. Well, I'm actually looking forward to seeing what happens in Damascus, and we'll keep posted on that and probably have you guys around maybe a year from now to, like, keep us updated on what's happening. So I want to thank Dean Apostle, Diana Lobo, and Stephen Messler for joining us. And this has been the Whole Communities Radio Project, sponsored in part by the Sound Partners for Community Health. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening.
With a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? It tastes paradise, put up a parking lot. We took all the trees, put them in a tree museum. And they charge the people a dollar and a half just to see them. Seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. You taste paradise, put up a parking lot. See, farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on apples, or leave me the birds and the bees. Please don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. The tea paradise, put up a parking lot. Late last night, I heard the screen door slam. And a big yellow taxi took away my old man. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? The tea paradise, put up a parking lot. I just don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. The tea paradise, put up a parking lot. the parking lot. The people don't put up a parking lot.